Good morning. Thank you. It's nice to be back in Stockholm in spite of the rain. I discovered on the way over here as I was thinking about this talk that I couldn't tell you what the Internet Architecture Board thinks about the future of the Internet in half an hour. There are 13 of us. We've probably got 30 opinions on the subject, partially because many of us have optimistic days and pessimistic days. So I decided I was going to tell you what I thought about the future of the Internet. And then I realized I don't know, because none of us do. But I want to talk about some things that may help or provoke you into thinking about the future of the Internet. And I'm going to say some things which are a little bit controversial, and which you may not believe, and I'm not certain I will believe by tomorrow, but with luck they will stimulate some thinking. There are many possible futures. Far more of them are determined by things at this stage besides the technology. There are economic and social pressures and constraints. Many organizations of many types wanting to pull the Internet in one direction or another, they may succeed. Policy issues, number of well-intentioned policy ideas may backfire and constrain the future or promote different futures. Innovation is unpredictable. It's very hard for us to guess what's going to come up tomorrow as a new idea. So I'm going to muse on history and some of the mythology about the evolution of the Internet and the process of prediction. And then I want to talk about convergence, because I keep reading in the press that convergence between the Internet and the telephony system is the future. And I don't believe it. We've seen very rapid innovation in the underlying technology, and people talk a lot about that rapid innovation. It's not quite as fast as we'd like to think it was, but we had very short periods of time between when the original packet switching papers appeared and when we had a running ARPANET. Many of these things have been driven by changes in technology which haven't happened as quickly as we think they have. In the 1960s, we were very happy when we saw 300 baud modems. Even happier, we saw things which were 1,200 baud one way. In the 70s, we concluded that 2,400 baud was the theoretical limit of what we could do with a modem. And we were right. And then people started thinking about compression and packets and error correction with modems, and we went back to the asymmetry which we discarded 10 years earlier. So we've gotten rapid innovation in low-layer technology. We moved from a rapid connection between a terminal and a host at 19.2 kilobaud and an ARPANET backbone at 56 kb, speed which we run into houses these days over modems. And we're now looking at various ideas to do optical things, which are very illuminating and very fast. But I'm not certain anybody cares. The people who build and sell these things care a lot. But most of the population doesn't care about pipes. They care about what flows through them, whether or not it gets there, whether or not it's contaminated. Graphics may be a counterexample at the low level to what happens quickly. We had vector technology in place by 1970 and knew how to do that. I had a device on my desk in 1975 which had a 2,000 square point display. Haven't gotten there again yet. Had raster equipment in production at the same time, but its resolution was really terrible. Haven't gotten there yet either. And it was very slow. So maybe things don't happen as rapidly as we think we do. They do. Applications are even more interesting story. We've talked about how rapidly the web happened and how rapidly it evolved and how interesting things are happening with digital libraries and about email and instant messaging, and I'm going to use them as examples about how we might think about the real future. I'm going to argue that major developments actually happen very slowly. Vannevar Bush gave a series of talks in the mid-1930s which outlined the basic operational principles and design of the web. He finally published a paper on it in the late 1940s. 50 years later, we've gotten most of his ideas implemented. This is not very rapid overnight innovation, which comes from nowhere. Jay Licklider wrote a book in 1962, which turns out to have outlined most of the principles behind digital libraries. It even explained what the problems were. 40 years later, we're talking about digital libraries. We've got some implementations, but we still haven't figured out how to do stable identifiers. We still haven't figured out how to do variant form identity matching. We still haven't figured out how to determine whether or not two documents are the same if they're formatted differently or if they're translated. And we haven't figured out if a document is the same if we move it from one computer to another without changing the bits. And we haven't figured out if that answer changes if we leave the document on the original computer. This one relates to the web issue because some of the fundamental design errors made in the web have complicated this question, and we may have to go back and fix the web in fundamental ways in order to fix this question. And we are lousy at fixing deployed applications. That's one prediction about the future, which based on the past I will make with great confidence, which is that if we've got a deployed application and it mostly works, our ability to replace it with something which works a lot better but is incompatible has been just terrible. Email. If you'll DeSola Pool, give a seminar in around 1968, in which he predicted that email systems would evolve to be an international environment in which we would have two-way and multi-way communications, mailing lists, optional real-time use, multimedia communications. This is very interesting because popular books about the Internet claim that email was invented in 1971. I was using it on a daily basis in 64, excuse me, which makes that a little bit suspect. We've also invented integrated messaging a number of times. We invented it in 1966, in 1979, in about 1985, and then AOL came along and invented it in 1999. Once again, the theme here is that despite what it appears to the public and to some journalists, these are not overnight developments. They are long histories of thinking about these issues, watching them develop, discovering that the technology isn't quite good enough to actually implement them at the time, and then gradually having the technology catch up and the implementations catch up. Strange hypothesis, therefore, is that in looking at the future, we discover from looking at the recent history that the network technology does not drive these killer applications, but that the innovative applications come along years in advance and then wait for the network to catch up with them. On today's horizon, looking toward the future, there are some nightmares. Some people like these nightmares, others don't. It's getting toward Halloween. One of the nightmares for me is 500 channels of mindless entertainment replacing all other uses of the Internet. The people like that idea. The Internet presents fantastic opportunities for surveillance of people, integration of databases, and complete loss of privacy. Some people like that idea, too. We could return to charge-by-packet models and charge-by-minute models. We know they've wrecked systems in the past and networking ideas in the past, but there's some people who like those ideas. And there are a number of opportunities to fragment the Internet, turning it back from a worldwide environment into a lot of enclaves which really can't communicate with each other. We're trying to internationalize things now. If we get it wrong, we're going to discover the Tower of Babel was a simple, unidimensional, simplistic warm-up exercise. We could really do a good job this time. And then we ask ourselves how many years it took us to fix the Tower of Babel problem. It's been a long time. So I wanted to say a few words about convergence. I wanted to start looking back at the ways in which we have switched telecommunications and communications technologies at a distance in the past and whether or not we've made progress. Many cultures, we start out with signal fires on mountains. Very good range, very poor bandwidth. Sensitive to weather and a few other problems. For some purposes at least, we replace the signal fires with messengers on horseback carrying letters. Bandwidth improved, letters are pretty good. Speed went down. It's more robust, a little bit less sensitive to the weather. More sensitive to some other kinds of interruptions like highwaymen and arrows. But we didn't make that convergence by having the rider carry a torch to the destination, lay out signal fires in the home of the recipient and light them. So we discovered the messengers weren't very efficient. We found trains. I'm skipping several hundred years here. We discovered trains aren't always better. The messenger has more flexible start times. Bandwidth is slower. But horseback-mounted messengers do adaptive routing. They can change course to get around obstacles in their path. Trains are faster. They're more reliable as long as the path is available. Bandwidth is higher. But unless we're using a mixed mode, we don't load the horse in the train, put the rider on the horse, carry the horse and the rider on the train, and then unload the horse and rider at the far end, deliver the message, and switch horses. These seem like facetious examples, but you'll see where I'm going in a minute, I hope. Then we discovered telegraphs. Some places we discovered telegraphs before the trains, but we discovered these were alternatives, not things which replaced each other. With the telegraph, the bandwidth went down. Speed went up. Scheduling on message sending with the telegraph was much more flexible in the train because you could send things out in small packets. But we didn't try to simulate the train on the telegraph by putting messages in little capsules and pulling them along the wires. We did invent a variation on the technology with various pneumatic systems, but they're part of another conversation. Very bad routing properties. So then the telephone came along. With telegraph, we had a digital medium. We've learned in the last several years digital mediums have advantages over analog ones. And with the telegraph, we had high speed and poor bandwidth. Telephone, we went back to an analog technology with all the errors and loss rates associated with it, misunderstandings, difficulty of translating between languages and dialects and accents in real time. Bandwidth went up, but the accuracy went down. When we invented the central office switch, we managed to do something for the telegraph system, brought us telex. But it's not clear this is convergence. It's parallel systems for different purposes. We gradually got good at figuring out what the purposes were. The telephone system was designed around an extremely stupid terminal instrument. It was a big improvement when we got to 12 buttons. If you're going to design a system around a stupid terminal and you decide you're never going to be able to replace the stupid terminals, what you have to do is build a system with a very smart center if you try to do anything intelligent. So the design evolution of the telephone system has been to continue to make the center of the system smart to compensate for the limitations of the terminal. The intelligence of that central system may have peaked when operators were putting plugs into panels. We went backward with the central office switch in terms of communication intelligence. Because when I had a human operator, I could call that human operator up and say, when the person I am trying to reach gets home, if it isn't too late, would you put the call through? It's very hard to do that with a central switch. We're trying to figure out ways to do it, but it's hard to do it with a central switch. I could call the operator and say, I'm trying to reach Joe. The operator could tell me, no, there's no point trying to reach Joe at home. He's at the store. Would you like me to try him there? And I could say, no, it's not worth bothering him at work. I'll call him at home in the evening. We can't do that with a central office switch. So the intelligence of the telephone system took a big step downward when we took the operators out. But we took the operators out because operators don't scale very well. I gather we're going to talk more about scaling. So we replaced them with switches. The switches weren't very smart. We tried to catch up. We discovered the signaling devices were stupid. Catching up became hard. If you have a dumb terminal network, one based around these stupid devices with 12 buttons, the terminal stays dumb. We put more and more cleverness in the middle. Cleverness is a problem. It tends to cause or lead to or be bound to complexity. Complexity leads to failures and surprises. We get fewer interactions. We get very, very slow diffusion of innovation because anything we do to those switches requires things which put everything we're doing already at risk. So we go through elaborate procedures taking years in some cases of testing and evaluation of anything new we deploy. And there's a requirement for central planning because if there are two conflicting applications, we can't run both of them. So maybe what the telephone environment has come to talk about is that an intelligent network is a dumb idea. The Internet was designed the other way. Maybe by good luck rather than careful, rational thinking, but designed the other way. Stupid network, smart devices at the ends. That's led to a situation in which we can do easy and rapid innovation because the network doesn't care what's being run over it. So once we figure out what we actually want to do and we have the power to do it, we can deploy things very quickly. As I've suggested earlier, we've actually turned out to be much better at figuring out what to do than we have been at delivering the power. The mythology thinks it's the other way around. And we can do these things at very low complexity. Can do them at very low complexity. Are we smart enough to do them at low complexity? We used to be. I'm not certain we still are. We're seeing more and more things invented and deployed on the Internet which seem to be driven by the inventors figuring out how they can show off their intelligence by making things very complicated. Probably it's the case that with a stupid network and smart end devices as contrasted with a network which is smart in the middle and has dumb end devices, we ought to be thinking about different kinds of communications models, not how to take the old communications models and do them over again. Before I come back to that one, my two other nightmares. This notion of a stupid network which doesn't know what it's carrying with smart end devices leads to what we call in Internet terminology the end-to-end model. We may be losing it to clever ideas. Some of those clever ideas are self-inflicted wounds in terms of the design. When we make a stupid mistake in the Internet design, we create business opportunities for people to come in there and deploy more stupid mistakes at very high profit to get around the first range of stupid mistakes. But it's killing us. We may be converging on a smart, overcomplex network with smart edge devices that try to outsmart the smartness in the center of the network. Multiplication of complexity among those combinations, and we don't know where that goes. That's the depressing story. So where does this convergence story lead? Well, if we've got smart terminals at both ends and interpersonal communication, and incidentally, this may look like a phone, but it's not. It's beginning to approach a smart terminal. But we're using it to simulate those stupid 12-button devices. It even looks like one. We don't want to talk with a legacy identifier of a trunk or instrument. A telephone number is derived from the assumption that you're putting a call through to a device, which may serve more than one person or even more than one household historically. You're typically trying to reach a person or a function. Conversely, you probably don't want to be at the mercy of anyone who wants to reach you. We're inventing very crude technologies for controlling who can interrupt you at what times of day, but they're still pretty bad. Legacy of stupid instrument at the ends, intelligent network in the middle. Lousy authentication technologies. You probably want to turn communications modes back into a negotiated relationship. I want to be able to control who can actually get through to me when I'm sleeping. It's not zero people, but it's not everybody. When a call is placed, the destination is typically a person or group rather than an instrument. In a perfect, in a more perfect world at least, it's a request to set that call up with a combination of attributes and requests. How important do you think it is? How quickly do you want the call to go through? How much disruption you're willing to cause the person at the other end? How you want to reach them? Maybe voice and integrated messaging and email and video and faxes are all the same thing. And the recipient ought to be able to control that as well. Maybe you think you want a voice call, but I want email. Interruptibility ought to be under control of the recipient. Ought to be a range of choices, recipient solutions, sender requests, rules, preferences. Ideally, I ought to be able to raise your preferences because I think you're more important to me than you do. I ought to be able to reduce somebody else's preferences because I never want to hear from them again. In that environment, what we've been thinking about as a phone call is a special case. It's a two-party, no advanced scheduling, known receiver, location, at a device, audio only. Important special case, probably given history, but a special case. And that brings us to the current convergence argument about which many of you have probably been hearing quite a lot. That's how we do telephony on the internet. And the so-called enum incarnation of that situation. Patrick will be talking about the details tomorrow, but I suggest in terms of the future of the network, it's irrelevant. And so is the telephone. Telephones are interesting. I've now told several long-distance carriers for whom I've worked or consulted in the U.S. that we're getting ourselves into a very strange situation. We're taking a business in which there is very little money to be made and less as time goes on, low marginal return, which we know how to run very, very well, in which all the capital costs are written off. No more design costs in that system. And we are talking about replacing it with an environment which is lower marginal profitability, high capital costs, we don't understand how to run, and the customer support costs are huge. This is not smart. So maybe the telegraph is the right answer. And we need to worry about telephony transition, because telephony is very, very good for some things, but it may be good for those things as telephony. And worrying about integration of the internet, of telephony over the internet and telephony signaling over the internet, has a lot to do with loading the guy with the torch on the train, carrying him to the far end and lighting the signal fire on somebody's front doorstep. This all makes the future very hard to predict. I'd encourage you to think about your own futures and try to make them happen. We've still got an end-to-end system in which that's possible, although that may not be the case if current trends keep up for very many more years. We might want to go back at predicting the future and look at the ideas from a dozen years ago or a few years ago, which were very good, but which we were not able to realize. And we should avoid constraining the future to what we've been used to and what we've been doing for the last 30 years. I'll take questions if you have them. But I encourage you to go away and think about it. Thank you very much.